Hey guys, welcome to this week's episode of Lost Origins, your number one radio show for all things ancient mystery, alternative historical theory, and lost civilizations. Check us out online at lost-origins.com and make sure that you sign up for that free newsletter. You can also connect with us on social media. We are on almost every platform, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play. Hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. This week's episode of Lost Origins is brought to you by Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Inner Traditions has been publishing books on esoteric philosophy, New Age spirituality, and alternative health for well over 40 years. You can check out their website at innertraditions.com, and at the website you can learn more about their books, their authors, you can sign up for catalogs, coupons, and special offers. I read tons and tons of books on esoteric philosophy, ancient mystery, so on and so forth, and I have to say that some of my all-time favorite books have come out of Inner Traditions and Baron Company. Their authors are some of the top researchers in the field, and you will not be disappointed when you pick up one of their books. We need to take a moment today and send a massive thank you to every single one of our listeners and our readers out there. Watching Lost Origins grow has been an incredible experience, and honestly, this thing took off so much sooner than we ever anticipated. So it's been a blast interacting with you guys, and we've got some pretty exciting things in the works for you. So to anyone who has ever read or shared an article, or anyone who has ever listened to, downloaded, or subscribed to an episode of our show, we want to send the warmest thank you to you. So I am so excited for this week's show that we're going to be rolling out for you guys. Today, we are going to be able to discuss one of my all-time favorite topics, the Anunnaki, and we are fortunate enough to be joined by researcher and expert, Dr. Chris Hardy. Dr. Hardy has authored many books on the topic, including Sacred Network, DNA of the Gods, and she has an upcoming release titled Wars of the Anunnaki coming out later this summer. Today, we're going to be discussing her research on the Anunnaki, her theories surrounding the creation of man, as well as her take on the parallels between cuneiform tablets found in the Middle East and the stories found in the Bible. All that and more coming up right after the break. Ladies and gentlemen, and we are back. This week's episode of Lost Origins is going to be a fast-paced, mind-blowing experience surrounding one of my all-time favorite topics, the Anunnaki. And fortunately, today we are joined by researcher, author, and expert, Dr. Chris Hardy. Dr. Hardy is a cognitive and systems scientist. She holds a PhD in psychological anthropology. And she is an ex-researcher at Princeton's Psychophysical Research Laboratories. Dr. Hardy has spent the last two decades investigating non-local consciousness and thought-provoking mind potentials. She's also the author of more than 50 papers and about 15 books on the subjects. She spends a lot of her time traveling and exploring various knowledge systems, cultures, and she maintains a very keen interest in Eastern religions, shamanism, and esoterica. So it is my very, very outstanding pleasure to welcome all the way from Paris, Dr. Chris Hardy, to this week's show. Dr. Hardy, thank you for joining us this week.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew. I'm also extremely happy to be on your show.
Well, the pleasure is all ours, trust me. Before we get started, 50 papers, 15 books. That's insanely impressive. When do you sleep?
Since I did my doctoral thesis, I have reduced my sleep to about 5 or 6 hours by day.
Sure.
And last year was even lower.
Well, I've read your work, and not all of it, but what I have read is incredibly impressive. It's very thorough, very well researched, and the way that you put all of the data together is very easy to follow, especially for a layman like myself. So I commend you. Your work is fantastic. So before we dig into all things Anunnaki, could you share a bit with us about your background? How did you get into researching and authoring books on the Anunnaki?
Well, it was, as you said yourself, it was not my main research in my life. I've been mostly researching consciousness in two ways, both in a theoretical way, to try to understand the workings and the possibilities of not only consciousness, but also psi phenomena. Mm-hmm. And that was the subject of my doctoral thesis already. And the other way was to try to work on myself. And that's why I started to travel when I was just after my Bachelor of Arts, 21 years old. I just went at last, waiting for many years already. I went on the road and traveled all the way, India and the Middle East and then Africa.
Oh, wow.
Yes, and then the also Eastern countries, Asiatic countries. So that was not my main line of research. But what happened is that a few years back, I just suddenly started to read Zecharia Sitchin's book on the Anunnaki.
Sure.
And I got absolutely fascinated, but beyond the fascination, I just could not believe what I was discovering. Mm-hmm. I mean, the fact that we had a family of... a royal family coming from another planet and that were saying themselves that they came from another planet, that we had an incredible load of tablets in six or seven different languages. Mm-hmm. That were like 5,500 years old, and that were describing the same events as we find in the scriptures. Was just mind-blowing. I mean, it just shattered everything I had understood about this, the information was kind of going like, the myths that you find in the Bible are also in Sumerian tablets. But when I was reading those texts, especially with the translation that Sitchin gave, which was because he was the only one person, I mean, the first one, after, of course, some other people came.
Sure.
But he was the first person to understand that when the tablets were saying that such a goddess like Inanna flew with... her bird, like a bird, you know, to Egypt, that in fact she was flying in her bird and not like a bird.
Sure.
You understand? So many things like that, like the name for rocket in Sumerian, which is Shem, is systematically translated like a name. To get a name, to have a name. And those sentences have absolutely no meaning at all. Mm-hmm. It's just unbelievable that they would stick to that because they have no idea what it could be. And because they have this ingrained worldview that everything started writing, agriculture, everything started in Sumer only 5,000 BC. They can't believe that we have civilizations that were very, very advanced in our own past on Earth.
Right. Mm. Well, and now we know that humanity, at least as far back as we understand in terms of civilization, agriculture, animal husbandry, architecture. You know, we have Göbekli Tepe in southern Turkey that dates back thousands and thousands of years earlier.
Around 10,000.
Right.
Years.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and yeah, I mean, it is unfortunate that, you know, there's kind of this veil that we're not allowed to peek behind, if you will, you know, and we kind of have this definitive narrative of what we think happened, and anybody who kind of goes against the grain, be ready to be railroaded, right?
So, yes. In fact, it's a kind of loop, a reinforcing loop. First of all, the person have a very precise idea of what could be our past, mm-hmm. and when agriculture started, and then when he tries to translate a tablet, of course he makes whatever he is writing as a translation to fit his own worldview. Okay, but then when we find evidence like Göbekli Tepe, as Andrew Collins was telling you, it had been already uncovered. Some stones had been uncovered long, long before we understood that it was very, very old.
Right.
But it was impossible even for those people digging on to just put together the story of something that was like 10,000 years old and so sophisticated. It was blowing off totally all our conception of our past.
Well, and stuff just keeps getting older and older too. That's what I find is so fascinating, is it
Absolutely.
Seems every single day you see something in the news about how our history, humanity's missing chapter, if you will, continues to be pushed further and further back into time. And so it's
but it's also, as I was saying, it's also the fact that we people who are talking about that were now obliging the people who have made a cover-up, like of the giant skeletons in North America, mm-hmm. With the Smithsonian Institute, or we have also an archaeological site that was closed in France, in Vichy, near Vichy, mm-hmm. because they could not believe it. They said it was a fraud. So no carbon dating, nothing. We have some skeletons that we should be able to date. But they are so incredible blockage, you know, that because it is earth shaking,
right.
It's shaking our paradigm, you know.
Well, and I think it's harder for us to accept that we may have been wrong. Right. I mean, for how many years, how much research was completed based on what we thought we knew? How many PhDs and master's degrees were handed out based on that data? And then all of a sudden we upset the apple cart. Right. And so that creates problems.
But I don't understand why, if not because of a religious dogmatic reason.
Right.
Why we should not accept as easily the fact that we have giants in North America that we could carbon date, as well as mummies, you know, that we could carbon date too.
Right.
And why carbon date and take their DNA, and why we should not accept this as easily as we're accepting from one day to the next that now we have Higgs bosons.
Right.
Or we have gravitational waves, you know?
Yeah, well said.
Thank you.
So my next question for you then, Dr. Hardy, is the Anunnaki have obviously spent some time in the spotlight over the past few years, and I think a lot of that is attributed to shows like Ancient Aliens on the History Channel. But for our listeners, with the amount of research that you've completed, can you give us some background on who were the Anunnaki, where did they come from, and what was their role with humanity?
Well, I think I'm going to try to wrap up this answer kind of quickly, because I believe that your listeners must be already very, very knowledgeable.
Sure.
And so I'm going to say, to set the stage for those who don't know, that basically we have to take for granted. Now we know we have to take for granted whatever is written in the enormous amounts, 100,000 and more tablets in 6 or 7 different languages, dating, as I said earlier, more than 3,500 years, 5,500 years old, because they were copies of copies. Mm-hmm. And we have to take for granted that the Anunnaki, who call themselves like this because it means exactly in Sumerian, An, sky, Ki, to earth. So those who came down from heaven to earth, mm-hmm. and we have to take for granted what they are saying, because they are giving us the same information on about the same events that we find in the Bible. However, the way they are giving this information is the style of writing is much more precise and casual. The their accounts are much more detailed. Mm-hmm. And how can I say that? The light they give on these events is a historical one. Mm-hmm. And it's one on which the historians can base their own understanding of the Sumerian civilization and the Akkadian Empire, etc.
Sure.
So they are our... the historian don't have so much qualms is in just taking the dates from the tablets and understanding what happened on Earth.
Sure.
You know?
Right.
But as soon as you are saying that now, yes, they are talking about technology. They are talking about nuking 5 towns in Palestine, something we find in the Bible. But the perspective in which it is said to us is totally different. It has absolutely no moralistic component, especially the weight of sin on the responsibility being all the time put on the poor humans. Mm-hmm. In the tablet, it's totally the opposite. It's in the tablets we have, contrary to the scriptures that we have been fed when we were very young with their own interpretation, contrary to that, in the tablets you have events that are so easily understandable in terms of politics, in between two brothers, two contending brothers, who have been fighting each other all the time. Mm-hmm. One willing just to impose, you know, his own dictatorial rule on right. Earth, which he did for so long, and because they were immortals, to our eyes. And at the same time, the other one, Enki, and Ninma, his sister, who was the chief scientist in life science, and who engineer humanity as in terms of biological, you know, genetic engineering. Mm-hmm. And this clan, Enki's clan, who started the Egyptian civilization, they were for humanity. They created a being that they wanted to be able to be wise, knowledgeable, having feelings and values, and they gave us, you know, our greatest quest, our thirst for knowledge. They were the one to give us that. And Ninma, who was the one who did the genetic engineering, the chief in life science, she did not stop trying to improve on the genome that she had engineered. Mm-hmm. They had used their own genetic material. They were aliens, but they were a human species. Mm-hmm. And they had mixed, she had mixed this genetic material of theirs with a hominid that was in the African jungles. And so they did this genetic engineering in her laboratory in Eastern Africa. That's it, the Rift Valley, you know. Uh-huh. Everything is getting perfectly well together. So we have to understand that there was this rift between a part of the royal family that came from a nomad planet, okay, mm-hmm. came down on Earth, and a part of this royal family with Enki, Ninma, and then Hermes, a son of Enki, I mean, who we call now Hermes, mm-hmm. Ningishida in the tablets, and they wanted to give everything to humanity, and they had understood that their own race was going to be extinct at one point, and they were hoping that humanity was going, I mean, the new humanity on Earth was going to take the lead of the civilization in this tiny part of the galaxy.
Hmm. It's so interesting, too. I mean, it really puts things in perspective, you know? And it really, what you just said sets the stage perfectly for my next question, which is, you open DNA of the Gods by explaining the story of Adapa and Titi, who are nearly identical to Adam and Eve from the Genesis narrative. And then we also find in the Epic of Gilgamesh, for example, the story of Upnapishtim, and that holds a very eerily similar context to that of Noah and the Great Flood. So what is your take on the similarities found between the Bible and then the ancient Sumerian cuneiform texts?
This is the main point about ensuring us ourselves of the evidence, the historical evidence that we can sort out from the tablets. The point is that we have not only the story of the flood, but we have so many, many events that have been accounted for in the biblical text, mm-hmm. and which are also accounted for in the tablets. So we are talking about the flood, but first of all, we start with Adam and Eve, okay? The only thing is that we have two couples and not one in the tablets.
Right.
So Adam and Eve, Adamu and Tiamat, in being engineer, yes, mm-hmm. created by the Anunnaki, yes. Then Enlil, the commander of Earth, asking them to come to Sumer proper from Africa, creating a garden for them, yes, called Eden, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. And then suddenly Enki, Ninma, and Ningishida, Hermes, are deciding to upgrade the first couple, and within the garden of Eden. Eden was Sumer, Mesopotamia.
Right. You know?
So within the garden, which was itself in Sumer, Mesopotamia, okay? And they do this last upgrading on the live bodies of Tiamat and Adamu, and they give them not only the capacity to reproduce, but also a higher degree of consciousness, which is self-consciousness. Mm-hmm. This is the symbolism of the Tree of Knowing. So, in the Garden of Anu, the king of Heaven, the father of Enki and Enlil, the commander, in the Garden of Anu, there were two trees, the Tree of Knowing and the Tree of Immortality, the mm-hmm. Tree of Life. And when Enlil wants the couple for his own praise, for his own glory, you know, to show that he now is taking everything for him, like he was able to create this new species, which, in my opinion, and for the people who are really a little knowledgeable about aliens and the problem of aliens surrounding Earth, I came to understand that, in fact, what happened is that they had, even if they gave us the Enki clone, they gave us a maximum of knowledge about their own planet, their origin, our origin, events that happened at the beginning and everything. Nevertheless, I believe, I came to understand that they were hiding from us a whole set of data that had to do with other intelligent species in the vicinity within our galaxy. And this would explain, in my opinion, if some people among your readers and yourself have read I don't have it at the moment, but the Uplift War, you know, then I am totally agreeing with this view that for an alien species to be able to bring about a new species of intelligent beings on a planet that they have colonized would give them a status, a very specific honor, you know, an honorific status within the, let's say, federation or club of space traveling civilization, intelligent space traveling civilization.
Sure.
And so they would get this status that now they are the master of a new species. You understand?
Right.
Oui. And so I believe that this could explain why when Enlil, the commander of Earth, who was inheriting his title of, he inherited not only the title of king of Earth, that was normal, he was chosen to be the commander of Earth, but he also inherited from his father, while his father was still alive, the title of King of Heaven. So he became the King of Heaven on Earth, which, you know well, is also in the scripture. And why? And then we know, you know, we have description of the king, of the two trees in Anu's garden. But now we have the son, while the father is still alive, who creates a garden, ask his brother to bring the first couple to this garden, show them around with pride, you know, and plant the two trees while his father was still living. So if you imagine that that the Anunnaki, I mean the Nibirians, were, by the creation of a new species, getting a higher status within the Federation of Intelligent Civilizations, then he would inherit the honorific symbols on the beings. You know, they were three gods. It's very shamanistic in that sense. Mm-hmm. It's like those two trees, had consciousness. They were not only conscious, like peyote, but they were highly divinely conscious. And so when he plants them in the garden in Sumer and brings the first couple, then it shows, you know, it's his own glory, mm-hmm. you know, that he take for himself as commander of Earth.
Wow. I mean, it's interesting, too, because it's not just those stories. I mean, we also find evidence of Cain and Abel in both the Bible and the cuneiform texts. It seems like there are so many commonalities between the Bible and ancient Sumerian cuneiform texts that it's almost impossible to ignore, right? Like, I know I've said it several times on the show, but if we have one singular existence of something in history, that's rather simple to discredit as coincidence or just a fluke. But when we have multiple instances of something pointing to an answer and we just ignore it, that to me is rather sad and rather ignorant.
Absolutely. I agree totally with you.
Go ahead, sorry.
Well, as a psychologist, the very, very important work that we can do on ourselves is through reading these tablets, you know, mm-hmm. understanding the right translation of mm-hmm. what's there and the right worldview of our ancestor. Is the fact that it totally overrides the blow off the interpretation of that we have in the biblical text, mm-hmm. which is called by the psychologists, by the way, and the biblical expert, it's called the sin and fault interpretation mm-hmm. of the Garden of Eden. Namely, when you go through all those incidents that are found at the same time in the tablets and in the Bible, and I have a fantastic tool to do that, which is my own semantic fields theory, uh-huh. which allows me to find out the specific semantic field of a part of, like, a proposition in the text. And so I am able to fathom the propositions that belong to a very specific person, a narrator, one, two, or three. Mm-hmm. I found three. And who has a very specific psychological profile and worldview. And then the very, very interesting point is that, again, there is absolutely no sin and fault implied in the Garden of Eden, so-called paradise, mm-hmm. because the only thing that happened, we were just like kids. We were like pre-pubere kids, okay? Understand that. Not even having the knowledge of animals.
Right.
But it's just like... on top of that, the tree of knowing is definitely the tree of distinction between not only good and evil, but just simple distinction between yes and no category, mm-hmm. you know, black and white or whatever.
Sure.
So this is a distinctive, this is the capacity of reasoning that was given to us by this upgrading in the Garden of Eden.
Wow.
So at that point, you can ask yourself one simple question among 100 that I pose in my book, mm-hmm. which is, how can you ever imagine that a kid who has not gotten to the age of reason, who has not gotten to the possibility of distinguishing between blue and green, mm-hmm. would be responsible for whatever happens to them that were done by the gods,
right? You know?
The brother and the other one.
Mm-hmm.
So the text we have inherited with their own interpretation attached forced on us when we were kids. When you are able to have the Sumerian tablets and their own description of the events, on the character of this one, on this one, on what they said, on the, who voted yes, who voted no, for example, the new king of Palestine. Why the new Palestine? Just because it was another god getting followers, not because there was a sin in Sodom or Gomorrah. Mm-hmm. They were totally free in their sexual life themselves. So that's how, you know, you can ask all kind of questions. And you ask yourself, but wait a minute, you know, why were we hammer with this story of an original sin when, in fact, I mean, what's how can you create a species and give them rules? They are kids, you know, mm-hmm. and wait for them to obey perfectly. And if suddenly they want to eat a fruit, then you damn them for the end of times.
Right.
I mean, it's a little, I mean, it has this interpretation when you have the Sumerian realities, you know, in the background of your mind, and you look again, and especially with my tool, as I said, that I go proposition with proposition, and I see what has been added, what is coming from the Sumerian tablet, because the whole text of the Book of Genesis is definitely grounded on Sumerian text,
right.
Ancient Sumerian text, with a lot of addition. So then you start looking at the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, as in my next book, soon coming out this summer, mm-hmm. Wars of the Anunnaki. And I'm really going, I'm you know, focusing on the Tower of Babel, which was Marduk's ideas of creating, believe it or not, a community where small, I quote, small and great would be on a par. So it was like the blueprint of all secret societies. Mm-hmm. We have in Sumer all the roots of all the symbols of the great religions and of initiatic lore.
Really?
Initiatic lore. Yeah. Yeah, that was at the end of my first book, DNA of the Gods. You will find whole chapters, one or two, on the two trees, on the shamanistic worldview mm-hmm. that they had, you know. It was incredible. I mean, on the work on symbols, to the point that we have the Ankh, we have the Templar cross, we have it's unbelievable. We have everything there, the initiatic transmission. So I came to call them wisdom lines mm-hmm. instead of bloodlines, you know.
Wow.
Because strangely, even if we have the DNA of our ancestor gods, nevertheless their transmission of knowledge, I believe, was not through only the son of Adam on Set, and etc. You know? Mm-hmm. So we have the 10 patriarchs up to Noah in the tablets. We have, of course, Noah everywhere in all the language, in, as you said, in the Epic of Gilgamesh, Utnapishtim, and then he has other names, and we have exactly the same account also with the Greek historian Berosus. I mean, it's just mind blowing. But the most important thing, as I was just saying earlier, is the fact that when you go through this those data, you know, you get to free your mind from whatever has been hammer on to you, you know, when you were very young in religion class, mm-hmm. and there is absolutely no way they can say, for example, as they did with this archaeological site in France, Closel, which they did not want even to carbon date, with writings, very strange writing. Mm-hmm. They put everything on, under the carpet. But you cannot do that with 100,000 tablets from everywhere in the Middle East. It's a little difficult. You cannot say it has been carved by the poor farmer who happened to fall in the hole and find this grotto, you know?
Right. Mm. Well, and I think it's you're right on the money where it's almost liberating. You know, I grew up in a Christian home, and so I was very familiar with the biblical stories. But once I started becoming acclimated to the Sumerian accounts, it's like reading the same stories, but with more information. And, you know, you had mentioned how the biblical accounts are basically repurposed Sumerian accounts with the addition of other information, which seems to be injected in there as a means for control or a means to teach ethical conduct or morality, basically to get people what you want them to do.
Yeah, yeah, but
from the standpoint of the church,
you are raising a very, very interesting point. Is that when I was working for this new book, specifically on the problem of the new king of the five towns in Palestine, including Sodom and Gomorrah, but mm-hmm. there were other ones. So I found out, because you have also to understand that we go from the story with a whole family of royals to one God that now has done everything. So who is going to take the fault if it is not the brother? Then it has to be the human beings. Mm. You understand.
Right.
The text that we have been handed down with the religion class are set to systematically give reason, absolve the one deity who said he was the only one. Mm-hmm. Okay? And this is perfectly astonishing to see that, because when you go deep into the two texts, I mean the law of Sumer and the law of our religion, then you realize that you have all kind of illogism. It's like it does not stand up by itself. It's full of very, very strange things that happen because you have to put the fault on the human beings. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, in the story of Sodom, okay, there is a deal made with Abraham. And when the two angels, which are emissaries, which are Anunnaki, mm-hmm. so other gods, because what do you do with the brothers? Your clan, they are angels. And the other ones, they are the devils. You know? Mm-hmm. So when the two emissaries arrive in Sodom, they forget everything about their the fact that they should have been seeing who was the faithful one, who were the rightful ones. Mm-hmm. So you have, and then, you know, you have a story. This book is full of absolutely atrocious stories, rape, homosexual rape with Sodom, totally superimposed to another story, mm-hmm. which is so political in the Sumerian tablets. It's absolutely nothing to do with anything moral, sexual, mm-hmm. etc. So we really have to go back, because I believe that those lies, to call them what they are, have been incredibly harmful for humanity, for the human species, and they have been done willingly. This is even worse. And then they have been imposed on the basis of those lies. We had a harassment of anybody who was thinking differently. We had a harassment the most awful harassment of women, keeping them down, which was already a story with a psychological profile of Enlil, but not the other side, Enki and Nina. So we really have to really get into the fabric, you know, and see the threads, and see exactly what's there, you know, and then decide what we want to do with it.
Sure, and that's fast. I can't wait for the new book, because it sounds like there's just so much data that has not been talked about yet, and so I cannot wait to get my hands on that. To shift focus real quick, I do have a question. You know, one of the main questions that we get here on the show about the Anunnaki, or the skeptics, right? They're going to cross their arms and they're going to say, well, if the Anunnaki came to Earth to mine for gold, or, you know, whatever reason they came for, where's the evidence, right? So based on your research and to your knowledge, what evidence exists that is indicative of the Anunnaki having actually been on our planet?
But the evidence is the writings they left.
Mm-hmm.
This is the first evidence. And this, we, as I said earlier, we just cannot put it under the carpet. Mm-hmm. They are clay, engraved on clay tablets. They are everywhere now in our museums. Okay. We have a very specific evidence of, everything. So many things that have been covered up. Why were those giant skeletons covered up in North America?
By the Smithsonian, right?
Yes.
Right.
But not only them. I mean, if they were there, me, I when I traveled to the Dogon country in Africa, I knew that they told us that they had giant skeletons hidden in the rocks, you know, in the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
So the skeletons giant skeletons are everywhere. Okay, we have discovered, I mean, you read David Childress' books,
mm-hmm,
and so many others. I mean, so evidence. The very interesting evidence is that they said that they were a nomad planet, okay? And how much time you give me, like 3 or 4 minutes?
Yeah, we're good.
Okay. So they said they came from a nomad planet that was kind of attracted in our solar system and started to cross this solar system all the way to, at one point, they reached the orbit of a giant planet that was there. And mind you, that all the description of the giant gaseous planets, the colors and everything were perfectly correct,
mm-hmm,
as Sitchin mentioned in his books. And then they arrived at the orbit of, so they were attracted by the sun, of course. So, mm-hmm, they crossed the planet from the outside to the sun, okay? And at one point they get to this the orbit of this giant planet, which was called Tiamat, the same name as Eve in the Garden of Eden.
Mm-hmm.
And when they reach this planet, they collide with this planet. And one of their moons is not their planet themselves, but the moon of their planet, or one of the moons of their own planet, collides with this giant planet. The giant planet is bursting off, and one part, a big chunk, is sent further inside the solar system towards the sun and will become Earth. That's what they explain in the Epic of Creation.
Hmm.
And the other part is exploding in billions of chunks that now are that they call at that time the Hammer Bracelet, and which is the asteroid belt, which are so many, many chunks, big and small, tiny, etc.
Right.
And so this is perfectly correct and sound in terms of science. Okay. Now, when they reach Mars, they say that they stop and replenish water on for them, you know, at one point. So, and then they talk about specific people that were, the name says Igigi, those who orbit and observe. So they were astronauts on they had an orbiting station, and they talk all the time of Anu, the king, who has remained on the ancient planet Nibiru, is all the time, of course, in correspondence with talking. You know, he has some sitcom system talking with Earth. And in the tablet, you see Enlil, when he wants to make a coup, and he goes on to the tip of Africa, mm-hmm. of South Africa, to take the clones of Adam and Eve that were working in the gold mine there, you know, to abduct them. And he doesn't want his father, at the time he was very ancient, to know what he's doing. On the tablet, the text says, and very swiftly, Enlil cuts the link between Earth and heaven. Very quickly, he cuts the link. And then you have the decision, the vote decision, you know, in the assembly of the gods.
Sure.
And the text says, for example, on the heaven to Earth, from heaven to Earth, the word came, la 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 la.
Right.
And from Earth to heaven, the word went, la 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 la.
Right.
So it's very interesting. So let's get back very quickly to conclude on this scientific type of evidence, mm-hmm. is the fact that we know now, but it's hardly 2 years. See my blog for that. Chris H. No, don't forget the H. Chris H. Hardy's blog, DNA of the Gods. And you will find that the nomad planet have been discovered to exist. And not only they are existing, but they can have an atmosphere, they can have moons, and of course, if they approach too near to a solar system, they will be attracted by the gravity field of this solar system.
Hmm.
This is perfectly correct. Then they will orbit the sun of this solar system. Okay. Now, they said in the tablets, Sitchin calculated the orbit of Nibiru to be 3,600 years. But we just, a few months ago, I just did a post, you know, for that, and that there was indeed a planet lurking at the edge of our solar system.
Right.
Which is so, have such an incredibly long and thin orbit, elliptical orbit, that we had not been able to pinpoint it until now.
Right.
And how long is the orbit? It's not 3,600 as Sitchin gave to Nibiru. It's around 10,000 years of an orbit. So no wonder that we have not really seen it, because it's still very far at the moment.
Right.
But now, and on top of that, another thing, we now have the information that there was what they call a paleo ocean on Mars, which means a very ancient ocean. Uh-huh. Indeed, it is like, let me remember, around 100 million years old, between 180 and 200. And that also a scientist, physicist, John Brandenburg, has discovered that there were traces and many scientists knew, but it was also put under the carpet for some time, that there are indeed traces of a very specific isotope of xenon 129, which make two huge spots on Mars near the coast of this paleo ocean. Mm-hmm. And those two spots, the presence of this isotope of xenon cannot be happening in a natural way. And it is the evidence of very, very ancient new king of Mars from the atmosphere that, in the opinion, for example, of John Brandenburg, where exactly what just blew off the atmosphere of Mars and made it a dead planet. And that's how the ocean is now totally, the planet is dead. Now. Mm-hmm. No water, nothing. But all this you find in the tablets.
All of it's in the tablets.
I mean, the water on Mars, the fact that Mars was a lush planet, that they were stopping there to take water, I mean.
That's insane. Okay. That's insane to me. I mean, that's just mind-boggling.
Yeah. It's not insane. It's extremely sane, but mind-boggling.
Right. Well, Dr. Hardy, I hate to have to wrap this up, but that's all the time we have for this week. I think we should definitely have a conversation about bringing you back on the show, because I only got through about half of my questions for you today, so we should definitely have that conversation.
Let's do that. But let's do that when my book is published.
Absolutely. And that's August 1st, right?
No, I don't know. They don't answer me. It's free time, ask them. It was mid-July, now it's beginning of August. I don't know.
Sure. A lot of steps that it has to go through.
But so. you can already buy it with pre-order forms on Amazon, everywhere.
And also through innertraditions.com, I believe.
True, absolutely.
So, very good. Well, Dr. Hardy, thank you so much for joining us today. We really do appreciate it. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. It was mind-blowing, as expected. So thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Andrew, and thank you to everybody.
It's our Bye-bye. Pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this week's episode of Lost Origins. Thanks to everybody who tuned in this week, and make sure that you hit that subscribe button so you never miss an episode or an article from your friends here at Lost Origins. If any of you have any questions for the show, or you have experts that you would like to hear from, please hop on the site at lost-origins.com, shoot us a message, and let us know who you want us to bring on the show. We've been fortunate to have some incredible authors and researchers, and we want to make sure that we're bringing people on the show that you want to continue to hear from. So get involved. Make sure that you check in next week with us when we're going to be talking with author and Atlantis expert Frank Joseph. Frank has authored many books on the subject, and his work is truly fascinating, so you're going to want to make sure you tune in to next week's episode. Until next time, I'm your host, Andrew, and I want you to continue to question everything.